So hello everybody. Welcome. Nice full class, which is really nice to see. Yes, my name's Miffy and we're towards the pointy end of our 10-week introduction to Buddhism called the Foundation Course. So for those of you online, you'll just have to battle through without being able to see any of the slides, but if you want to, email me and I can send you the PDF of them, no worries. For those of you here, all the slides will be up on the screen, so no worries. We've covered a huge amount already. Has anyone here been here from the beginning, roughly? So we've covered a lot of exactly what is a Buddhist being not so much a religion, but an inner being, someone who looks within for answers, for satisfaction rather than looking to external things that aren't very reliable, I suppose. And how to look within is all about meditation, which is caring for the mind. So, how to tame our mind so that we are the boss of our mind rather than our mind is the boss of us, or our delusions the boss of us. All of those agitated states of mind. Then we actually delved into what is the nature of our mind, and this is really fundamental to a Buddhist worldview of a really deep understanding that our mind is a continuity of mental moments, that its nature is clear and pure, and all of the disturbance and emotional turmoil that we experience is like all the toxins within the mind, and they can be removed. What are those toxins? Well, a lot of them are karmic imprints. So the imprints from actions that we've done in the past that are like toxins that we put in upstream, and then now in this life we experience the results and we go, why? Why did that happen? Why did it happen to me? So karma, as Venerable Robina famously said, is Buddha's answer to why. Why do things happen like this? We've in the last few weeks looked at what determines where we end up next, our next rebirth, what happens after we die. Part of it is to do with our karmic imprints, and part of it is to do with our state of mind at the time of death. So it's really important to be able to face death without regret or fear. And so that's why death is talked about a lot in Buddhism. Not because it's frightening, but because it's something that we can actually practice to take control of and die with a happy mind. And it's also a time where great meditators and possibly even some of us can, once the mind is really subtle in that kind of separating from the body, we can meditate and we can develop our wisdom. Because there aren't any distractions. And so last week, then we looked at bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, the biggest, best quality kind of mind, this altruistic wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all. And I keep on thinking, like, if only Donald Trump had have heard about bodhicitta, you know, because he's always after the biggest and best. But he just didn't meet the Dharma. Anyway, so were there any questions or anything that arose from last week about bodhicitta? Observations, thoughts, anything? Yeah, Georgie.
Yeah, this is a good question.
From that experience of being in a hospital, because hospitals, yeah, they're distasteful and everyone's at their worst, not at their best. It does, it works, that's right. Like His Holiness said, we are the first beneficiary of our own compassion. So instead of kind of becoming averse and kind of uptight in a hospital, thinking about. So I had a similar thing. I was kind of quite ashamed because every now and again, ambulances go past here, and someone in the class said, "Oh, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum." Every time the ambulance goes past, they say a prayer for the person in the ambulance, and I'm like, "I never thought of that." I call myself a Buddhist, and I never thought of that. Like, there is a trigger. You hear an ambulance, You think, may you be free of suffering, just like that.
Yeah.
Wow. And then, yeah, then your own life becomes better. And then you're not annoyed or whatever by the sirens at whatever time of day. And yeah, so that's really good to hear, Georgie. So this week we're looking at the nature of reality, nothing less than the nature of reality, which is the kind of wisdom that we want to develop. It's the kind of wisdom that we meditate on when if we've had some practice in the death process, we can meditate in a very refined way. The way that we meditate on the wisdom understanding reality is two sides of the same coin. So one's called dependent arising, and that's like conventional reality. And the other is called emptiness, or the wisdom realizing emptiness. And that's like the ultimate reality. And so conventional and ultimate, they're like two sides of the same coin. They're distinct, but you can't separate them. When we're trying to get our head around it, what happens is we kind of yo-yo between one and the other. And so hopefully we'll be able to avoid becoming nihilistic on one hand, or getting really kind of grasping and becoming substantialists or eternalists on the other hand. There's this middle way. So this is called the view, and this is what makes Buddhism different from any other religion. There, this kind of view or understanding of reality that isn't mentioned in any other tradition. And even when His Holiness the Dalai Lama came to Australia, and he visited the indigenous people at Uluru, and they spent some time together because there's a really strong spiritual tradition there. And he said there's so many similarities, especially with a tantric kind of approach, but the only difference is this view. That's where it changes. On a very subtle level, everything else so incredibly similar. So what we have is like the two wings of the bird. We've got on the practice side of things, compassion, altruism, good-heartedness, developing all of our ethics, patience, tolerance, all of those things. That's pretty universal. That's in every tradition. But on the other hand, the view, the other wing of the bird, understanding the ultimate mode of existence, this kind of description is unique to Buddhism. And so, according to Buddhism, and especially Lama Tsongkhapa, this view is the only way that we can actually be liberated, not just from samsara, but the causes of samsara. Because all of the practice of compassion and loving kindness and everything, it assuages the suffering, but it doesn't remove the causes of suffering. So if we want to remove the causes, we need the view. We need to understand what those causes are and cut them at the root. So this view also has direct implications for our life now. So just like bodhicitta and compassion and kind-heartedness make us feel better, having this view will also relax our mind. Straight away, we'll be able to be way more resilient and flexible. Let's just take a moment to set our motivation. So you can settle your posture so you're comfortable but still feeling alert. Imagine a fine thread of light inside your body running just in front of your spine, from the base of your spine up through your body and coming out the crown of your head. Feel as if your body is suspended from your crown so that your posture naturally straightens. And once your spine is straight, then relax the shoulders. And we can start where we are by just recalling what are the reasons that brought us here tonight. There might be particular questions, general curiosity. Particular problem or person that we'd like to help. All of these quite personal reasons and reasons close to our heart, we take them as a starting point and then expand it out to become a big altruistic intention for being here. That just as we ourselves want happiness and never suffering, so it is with everybody. So everything that we contemplate and learn and put effort into may benefit everybody who are just like ourselves. Then we can add in the extra motivation that may that benefit bring about complete liberation from cyclic existence, from the cycle of suffering, and may it bring about a state of lasting happiness for ourselves and others. So, apparently, according to the Buddha, there are 84,000 delusions that cause us to suffer. Yep, they've itemized them all, specifically, each one with its own name. And so, we might tackle a few. If we're lucky, we might overcome one affliction every what, month, year? One. 83,000 to go. So we can do it one by one. It's really overwhelming. And no wonder they say it takes three countless great eons for a bodhisattva to become enlightened, because it's a lot. So we can either do one by one, or we could just cut off the cause of suffering and delusion at the root. Cut them all off in one go. It's kind of like taking the pot off the boil. Instead of the pot is boiling and we just keep on putting in cold water. So that'll work for a while, won't it? But it's not sustainable. Or we just take the pot off the boil and then that's it. It's finished. It's going to cool down naturally. So, tackling the root of our suffering, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama often says, we're the ones who suffer. So we start with ourselves. That's how we tackle the root. So the root cause of our suffering is a mistaken grasping at a self that does not exist in the way that it appears. So in a way, this is saying the root of our suffering, it's about our identity. Oh, yeah. Can you check that the white PowerPoint is on too? Is that... So we have this, it's not even just a thought, but we have this feeling that there is a me in here. Because of this feeling and because of habit, we think that it's real and true and independent of anything else. And we just assume that it's, a standalone thing, and it must be true because I can feel it. And we can even go to great lengths to try and become completely autonomous, independent, not reliant on anybody, as if that was ever possible. And when our sense of self is threatened, that's the grasping at it. We hold tightly to it. And we know we do it because we think, no one talks to me like that. Or I did not do that thing. It wasn't me. So all of that is where we grasp to that sense of self. So it's actually the grasping to this mistaken idea of who we are that causes the problems, that makes us suffer. So if we start investigating this self, this real me, we can't find it. And so far, no one's been able to find it. So it's, I think you call it cognitive dissonance. We feel it's true, and yet we can't find it. So actually, when you have that dissonance, that's a good sign, because that means you're getting somewhere. No one's ever discovered an independent self, it just doesn't exist. However, because we kind of have this assumption and we have this feeling, we act under the influence of it. And so then all the disturbing emotions arise. We become intimidated. We get aggressive. We become acutely sensitive to how people think about us, talk about us, anything that harms our pride. So then we have a hostility to that. And anything that makes us feel better or that accords with our sense of self, we like and we want more of it. And then we have a whole culture that's a result of that, where you have selfies and you have, all the addiction to likes, all of this dependent kind of. Actually, if that self was real, we wouldn't need to be authenticated by somebody else. So hostility and desire and their cause, the self-cherishing mistaken image of ourselves, are the fundamental disturbances of our personal world. So this wisdom that we're looking at, the wisdom realizing emptiness or the emptiness of a real self like that, is the only way to cut our suffering at the root. And we don't start with the philosophy of it so much as starting with where it matters, which is our sense of I, of me, because that's who suffers, right? So who cares about how does this exist or that exist or all the fights that you can get into with philosophy? What we want to do is take the analysis that we use in philosophy and apply it right where it matters, which is this understanding of who we are. And if we don't, we're just going to keep acting under the influence, really, of our afflictive emotions, like drunk drivers, and ironically pushing away happiness and attracting suffering, even though that's the exact opposite of what we want. Even if we just develop the kind heart, it's not going to be enough. It's just like putting the balm onto the heart again and again and again, but at the same time, creating more causes for suffering. This is what Lamyeshi says. This great book, Introduction to Tantra, A Vision of Totality. So in this context, the correct view means the wisdom that clearly realizes the actual way in which we ourselves and all other phenomena exist. This wisdom is the direct antidote to all the mistaken conceptions we have about who we are and what the world is truly like. As long as we are burdened by these misconceptions, we remain trapped in the world of our own projections, condemned to wander forever in the circle of dissatisfaction we've created for ourselves. But if we can uproot these wrong views and banish them completely, we will experience the freedom, space, and effortless happiness we presently deny ourselves. Whenever we fix upon the idea that we exist in a certain specific way, we are hallucinating. Every time we look at ourselves in a mirror, we have such a fixed idea. How do I look today? Oh, I don't want people to see me looking like that. Although in reality, we're changing all the time. We're different from one moment to the next, but still we feel we have some sort of permanent, unchanging nature. Our view of the external world is just as deluded. Our sense organs habitually perceive things dualistically. That is, every sensory object that appears to us seems to exist from its own side as something concrete and self-contained, like out there. We think that merely because we can see, hear, smell, taste, and touch these objects, that they must be real and true, existing solidly out there in their own right, just as we perceive them. But this concrete conception we have about how they exist is also a hallucination and has nothing whatsoever to do with their reality. So this one to do with phenomena is something that science can easily prove. So one of the things that really blows my mind is when I was reading about you can push on your arm and you can feel it and you think, yep, I'm touching my hand. But actually you're not. Your senses tell you you are, but what's happening is that there is a force that as you push onto your hand, there is a repellent force. And that's what you're experiencing. You never touch your own hand. You can't do it. So our senses tell us one thing, and actually what's happening is another thing. Same thing with sight. We think all of what we see, color and everything, is out there by itself. But if you're colorblind, it isn't. So what's out there depends on the organ that is perceiving it. So this is a duality that we think it's me and all the stuff out there, but actually the stuff out there is there because of me. They can't exist by themselves. Oh no, it's mind-blowing, literally. So don't worry, we've got a method. So what we do is we take the two sides of reality, like the two sides of the coin, and we use one side to establish the other. So the easy one is called dependent arising, conventional reality. We can all get at this. So we establish how conventional reality exists, and then we get the therefore things are empty of being true or inherent or solid or fixed or all of those things. So the dependent arising means things don't exist in a vacuum by themselves. They depend upon other things. What do they depend on? Three levels of ways of existing. So the first level is called causes and conditions. Things depend on other things, on causes and the conditions. It's like the nature-nurture thing, it's both. And those causes and conditions are continuously changing and disintegrating. Things also exist on their parts, the parts that they're composed of, physical parts, parts of time. And things are dependent on a mind that conceives of them and names them or labels them. So on name or imputation. And this is really powerful. We can experience this. Like if there's something wrong with you feel you're sick, you want to know what it is, don't you? And you can't rest till you get a name for it. Then you go, oh, that's what it is. Really good point. So if you discover that, say, what's wrong with you has a label and it's some kind of affliction, now suddenly it's not you. Now it's some kind of a problem or an illness or a neurology or something that you have to work with, but it's not you. And not only that, but it's not fixed in stone, because all you have to do is change one of those conditions and things will change. So this is both physically and psychologically. So already it can have an effect on our life of possibility. So these are like three levels getting more subtle as they go on. And I've got some examples that we'll go through tonight. So you look at this and you go, okay, so this is how things exist, not in a vacuum, but on these different dependencies. Therefore, all things are empty of existing in an independent manner. So when we say emptiness, that's what we mean, empty of something. Empty of being inherent or true or real or fixed or permanent, all of those things. Empty of existing in a fantasized manner. So, in layman's terms, that just means what exists is something else from what we ordinarily believe. And if we have this realization, if we can apply it in our life, this is the antidote that cuts through all the disturbing attitudes at their root, this realization of emptiness. Once we have this realization, it's impossible to suffer. Even if you wanted to, you couldn't, because the cause is gone. So it doesn't mean you're a fully awakened Buddha yet, but it means that you've cut the root of suffering. And so that's really what nirvana is, this state where the cause of suffering is removed. So I thought I'd give you a couple of examples and we can do a meditation. So here's one. So yes, appearances are not reality. We have appearances. How we first experience things is not the whole story. So we know that. Don't judge a book by its cover. But why do we even have that saying? Because we do. That's right. First impressions matter and they get stuck in our mind. And if we get off on the wrong foot, it's really hard to change it around. And how we experience reality and first impressions is coloured by our backstory and the other person's backstory, isn't it? It's like, it's kind of a live wire. It also means so that appearances are not reality, meaning that things are impermanent. They'll change. And yet, the stronger an emotion is, I've found, the more we think it's going to last forever. You know, when we're really upset, our whole world becomes pain and suffering and upset. And we just think because it's so overwhelming, it is forever. And the same thing, when things are going good, we just think, oh, it's natural. We're really shocked when they come to an end. So again, the appearance, we have this appearance that doesn't accord with reality. And with our feelings, I've put this point in here that how we feel, it's valid, but it's not necessarily true because we don't want to go too far and end up gaslighting ourselves. So when you're upset or when your pride is hurt or when your self-esteem is in the gutter, or when you're experiencing physical pain or illness or difficulties, all of that suffering, that's valid. That is suffering. No one wants it. But how we relate with it and how we describe it to ourselves and how we think it's going to last forever and it's somebody else's fault and all of these things, that bit's not true. So it's a valid feeling, but it's not true. And this shows us the way out because if we can analyze it, we'll be able to open the door to change that experience. So the external conditions may not change, but how we experience them will. Okay, before I go to the next bit, how are we going? Good. Questions? From a Buddhist point of view, and possibly from a parent's point of view as well, you can't say a baby is born as a blank slate because they come with their own stuff. They come with their own karma. Because how different are, you know, siblings? But they are empty, but empty of what? Yeah, and even like before they have a name, like it's just the baby. And then suddenly the parents alight on a name, and now, oh, it's Jim or it's Will or it's Amanda. And now that's who you are. Before that, you're the baby. You're generic. So, yeah, when we say empty, we've got to be thinking empty of what? And it's interesting you bring that example up of a baby because a baby also, you know, my baby, it depends on causes and conditions and parts and name. And so I read this story a couple of years ago where two babies were accidentally switched in the hospital and it was just a few weeks later that they realized. And so then they told the parents. And so the mother, when she found out, not her baby, she had this feeling of revulsion to that baby. I know, isn't that shocking? So that's grasping at inheritance. My baby, all these ideas, and now you change the name, not your baby, and now revulsion. Yeah, it's so sad, isn't it? But this is where we get into trouble because we don't realize that My baby depends on all these different factors, not just on genetics, but on labeling it as mine. And then you have all the feelings of mine. So let's have a look at a really super easy example, and then we can do a little reflection. So causes and conditions. Here's a leaf. We have things exist on these three levels of subtlety. If you're like me, not really a gardener, I'd be hard pressed to tell, is it a leaf or is it plastic? I mean, up until I had cats, half the plants in my garden were plastic. I just shoved them in the ground, but then the cats came and they ate the plastic, so I had to get rid of those ones. But then my garden didn't look as lush. But okay, so if you're a gardener, you look at a leaf, you see more than just a leaf, don't you? You see possibly what type of leaf it is. You know that it comes from some kind of seed. You know whether it's healthy or not, if it's got whatever damp rot or whatever they get in my So we know it comes from causes and conditions. It didn't just go poof out of nowhere. We know it's come from a plant. We might not be able to see the plant, but we get all of that. Okay. So if we got that leaf and then we looked at its parts. We put it under a microscope. Now, what we see is really different, isn't it? We see a cellular structure, this bit, that bit. The leaf disappears. Now we're looking at something else. All the parts of the leaf, and they all have names as well. And we look at those parts, the green bit that fills it in, and the little spines, and we look into those, and they all look different. All the different parts. And so when you're looking at the parts, it's really hard to see a whole leaf because now you're looking at the side of the leaf or the middle of the leaf or. And you can look even further, like onto a quantum level. You can look at its atoms. You can look at the space between the atoms. And actually, as you go down even into quarks and all those things, not just on a molecular level, but then onto the quantum level, a leaf actually only exists in probability. When you look at the very small, it exists in probability. It needs an observer. Before that, it exists in a possibility. So, and we're all familiar with this diagram, of the atom on the neutron or whatever it is. That's not how it looks, is it? That's just it's an abstract diagram to help us think about it. So even that is just a name. So we have all three levels. They exist simultaneously, but when we're investigating it, we go deeper and deeper, more and more subtle. And so when you're trying to find the leaf, you go in from here's a leaf. Well, everybody knows that's a leaf. Sure. And then you go, well, where actually is it exactly? And so you put on the microscope and you go, oh, there it is. It's all the cells. It's like, well, where are they exactly? And you look in and then you go and you look at the atoms. And then you look inside those atoms until you get to the quantum field, which doesn't exist. It exists in probability. And this is where Buddhism and science dovetail really, really nicely. The way that we think about this, the non-finding of something when it is sought, trying to find a leaf, not finding it when it's sought analytically, is the emptiness of that object. So a leaf does exist, but not inherently. There's a leaf conventionally, but when you look for it analytically, you cannot find it, and that's its emptiness. So when we first, you should see yourselves, you're all like this, all identically. It's perfect. Yeah. When we do this, we go, oh yeah, oh yeah. But then I find I'm like a pendulum. I swing wildly over here. There is no leaf at all. No, that's wrong. There is a leaf because here we are having a conversation with it. So what we're doing is we're getting into this middle way. Yep, They do. So we have different names. So a leaf in German or French will have a different label. So it's a label on a valid base, and that's its conventional reality. But when you try and find where exactly is that leaf,
In time and space, you say.
yeah,
Yes.
cannot be found. Well, even energy, I mean, energy on a quantum field, our scientific instruments now go right into that. And until you get to the most subtle level, the quantum field of probability, that things are more likely existing than not. So, I mean, why I've used this example is because it's a fairly easy one to grasp, but I have a better example coming up. But let's do a reflection first. Okay, so let's bring this into our experience. So getting comfortable, allowing any agitation to settle, like water becoming still and reflective once the wind has stopped. And set an altruistic intention for oneself and others to be able to loosen our suffering at its root. And imagine that you're a little kitty at your fourth birthday party. And cakes and drinks come out, and oh my gosh, it's blue milk. And all the adults laugh at you because actually it's in a blue glass. So, what do you usually assume is exactly as it appears in your own life? As if it's something fixed inside the object, like blue milk. And then imagine that a few more birthdays go by, and now you're just asking questions. Mum, why is the sky blue? Well, blue isn't actually blue. Blue is all the light wave colours except blue, which is repelled and bounces back to hit our eyes. And blue depends on our eyeball because our cat just sees the sky in sepia. So, what other things in your life might seem solid and obvious, yet depend on your viewpoint? And another few years go by, and now you're decorating your room, painting it blue. But the blue in the shop is not the blue on your walls. It's changed because the light's different. The other walls reflect the blue, making it appear far more intense. So, what other instances in your life change when the context changes? And then a few more years go by, and now you have a successful job and are on a holiday skiing in the Blue Mountains. And you put on your tinted sunnies and instantly the snow is blue. You're looking at a blue snow mountain, but you are ascertaining pure white virgin snow. Can you feel how you relax into letting things appear vividly without insisting they exist exactly the way they appear? And now a few more years pass by and you've renounced the corporate world and met the Dharma and been in deep retreat cultivating the path of seeing. And as an Arya Bodhisattva, you still see the same appearances as us ordinary people, but you do not believe it. Like white snow, seemingly blue behind tinted sunglasses, can appearance and reality lucidly coexist? So enjoy the exquisite balance between dependent arising and emptiness of true blue. And carry this awareness into your day, dedicating for a kinder and clearer world for yourself and others. And take a nice deep breath and bring your awareness back to the room. So there is a study they did with little kitties, handing them milk in coloured glasses, and up to I think the age of four, it was blue milk. And then after that, they went, oh, don't be silly. So we can too, right? Okay, so how to avoid nihilism? So again, on the relative level, phenomena do exist, but interdependently. They depend on all sorts of things. Ultimately, they're empty of existing in an independent, autonomous, unchanging way. So we can say that, we can get our head around it, we can memorize it, but still, when we're trying to actually, I kind of call it applied emptiness, when we're trying to apply it in our life, it gets tricky. So what emptiness is not, it's not that nothing exists at all. That's kind of gone too far into nihilism. And that's really what the existentialists and the nihilists did. They went too far because they didn't have the wisdom of Lama Tsongkhapa to draw upon, did they? So it doesn't mean that things are non-existent. Of course, we're all having this conversation about it. We all exist, and suffering exists too. It's just that they're empty of existing in a certain way. And occasionally, I've heard emptiness be a bit bastardized in Dharma centers, where a problem will arise and someone will say, oh, it doesn't matter, it's empty anyway. And it's like, big red flag, folks, because conventionally it does exist. We can't negate that. How it exists is different from what we think, and that's why we can work with it and change it. But just because it's empty doesn't mean the problem doesn't exist at all. And you believe that to your own peril, you get a lot of trouble that way. And again, it's not a complete negation. It's not a blanket negation. There is nothing. It's actually very specific. And so the way to help ourselves with this is to ask, empty of what? One of the nuns, Venerable Saipul, she used to bring her wallet in and go, like, for instance, my wallet, what's it empty of? It's empty of money. My car, what's it empty of? Petrol. It's empty of something. And what that something is a, we're empty of an independent existence or an autonomous existence or a true existence. Doesn't mean we're empty of existence altogether. And the last one, you might have heard this one, a life is like an illusion. And so there's a real nuance here. It's not that life is an illusion, but it's like an illusion. And this is a really important distinction, because if life is an illusion, then it's not, you know, it doesn't exist at all. But you think about an illusion. An illusion does exist, doesn't it? That's why we enjoy them and pay to go to magic shows. And there is something, that's why magic shows are so fantastic, because we get this experience of something appearing one way, and yet we know it's impossible. And why is that so fun? Because it's actually this, it's busting up our idea of inherent existence, and that is a blissful feeling. So everything is like an illusion. So an illusion does exist, but we know it appears one way, but what's happening is a whole nother thing. And we can very easily train our speech with this, just to, in your mind, instead of, oh, everything's an illusion or everything's illusory, everything's like an illusion. And just train in saying that. It'll really help. Because it's not that everything is a figment of our imagination, because if you go down that track, then suddenly, well, then everything doesn't matter, and it doesn't matter what I do or you do, and so then we can just start acting out or disregarding people or disregarding ourselves, and you know that just creates more suffering. And actually, this if we get this wrong, it can lead to becoming an obstacle to spiritual development. If we go too far onto the nihilistic side, you can become quite hard-hearted then. And once it takes root, it's very difficult to eradicate. And so there's all sorts of Buddhist jokes about, I hate to say it, cranky old men that reckon they all know about emptiness and whatever, and they're just awful to everybody. And that's not just in the West, but it's been ever since, like Lama Tsong Kapa's day all the way back, because it is a spiritual pitfall where you can have this academic understanding, but if we haven't applied it to this sense of I, it doesn't, it's not helpful. So our identity, it appears to exist in one particular way, but in fact exists in a totally different way, and that's kind of like we believe the mirage of our identity. So this is from Thupten Chodron, Buddhism for Beginners. So another analogy for the view of ignorance, which is this self-grasping ignorance that we have, is an audience who watches a movie and thinks that the people on the screen are real. The viewers become very emotional and involved in the fate of the characters. Wasn't the first movie, I think the first movie ever made was by the Salvation Army in Australia. And everyone, and it was of a train coming towards you. You guess what happened? The stampede out of the theatre. Anyway, so being attached to the hero, they're antagonistic towards the characters who threaten them. The audience may even cry out, cringe, or jump up in their seat when the hero is harmed. In fact, these reactions are out of proportion, for there are no real people on the screen at all. They are only projections which are dependent on causes and conditions, such as the film projector, and the screen. Realizing emptiness is analogous to understanding that the movie is empty of real people. However, the appearance of the character does exist, dependent on the film, the actors, the screen, and so forth. If we understand this, we can enjoy the film but no longer go up and down emotionally as the hero experiences various events. So, I mean, this is what we do when we watch horror movies, isn't it? Yeah, that's what you go, it's just a movie. And you look around at the rest of the theatre to you know, make sure. And you tell yourself it's just a screen and a projector. It's not real people up there. But you see, because our self-grasping, it sticks, doesn't it? The appearances stick. So we have this physiological response. Even though we know intellectually it's not real, we still get terrified. And to this day, I can remember seeing the ad for Poltergeist when I was a little kiddie and the head spinning around, and I can't get that out of my mind. And I'm still terrified by it. And not only that, but, you know, some actors are really loath to take some roles because they know that role is going to stick with them and people think that's them. Who was the lady out of Prisoner? The bitch? Yeah, that's right. Your face all just went all... Yeah, like I don't know how she ever managed to go to the shops because she was so universally hated as that character. Okay, so here we go. Let's have a little really quick analysis of selflessness of I. So here is this another term in Buddhism. Selflessness here means no inherent self. We're merely an I imputed to body and mind. And so each have three levels of dependent arising. So the body, causes and conditions, pretty clear, DNA, egg and sperm. But again, if you find out that your babies were switched at birth or that you're adopted, for instance, that has profound effects. If we think that that's all we are is just genetics. Parts. So we think, oh, yeah, this is me, pretty obvious. But our body is made up of parts. So what if you lose one part of your body? You haven't lost you, have you? It's not like if I chopped off this bottom half of my leg and chucked it over in the corner, it's not like I'm in the corner. So I find this really interesting. I love watching Botched, you know. And so they often do these operations where they take off bits of you, like they do a skin reduction from someone who's lost a lot of weight. And it just turns my mind inside out because they're there on the table and there's the big fat belly. And then they cut and then suddenly it's a piece and it's going into the garbage bin. And it's like person, 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 not person. When did that happen? I can't get enough of it. It's so amazing. So we think we are our body, but yet when we start looking, actually it's all the different parts. And we can pretty much interchange most of them. I also remember in terms of, say, gender, as a kid, you'd be able to tell who was a girl and who was a boy by how long their hair was. Remember that? And even to this day, I remember just recently seeing a movie where little kid in the movie had long hair, and so I assumed it was a girl. Halfway through the movie, I realised it's a boy. Yeah, that's right. 70s took care of that. Yep. And so then... Actually, the one that has the most powerful impact on us is the mere name, especially when it comes to gender, because we think gender is a duality. It's never been a duality. It's a spectrum. Mm-hmm. And it's just been a duality for, you know, convenience, and it's even then it's not very convenient. There is no actual definition of what male or female are. There's no universally acknowledged definition. Can't be found. This is what's really interesting. So the whole athletics, International Athletics Federation, tried to develop a definition of what a man or a woman is as to tell which race they're going to run in. And they couldn't. They got this whole committee, about 13, 14 different people, geneticists, endocrinologists, all sorts of things. And even then, there's so many kind of different dependencies. Like it's not even by how much testosterone or estrogen you have in your body, because some women have huge amount of testosterone, but their body can't use it. So it doesn't count. So you have to eliminate all of these things. So in the end, they have this committee and they vote on a case-by-case basis. And that's as good as it gets. So even then, you think it's a no-brainer, and yet it's not. So what it depends on is a conventional decision on mere name, imputation. And we kind of need to have this so we can get organized as a society, but thinking that it's true gets us into trouble. So that's the selflessness of the body. Cannot find a real one in there. There's also similar for the mind. So causes and conditions for the mind. How we feel after a good night's sleep as opposed to how we feel after a sugar crash really change the state of our mind. How we get triggered. We get triggered by a smell or by a song. Just those things influence our whole mind, state of mind, causes and conditions. All the parts, what we identify as, all the different roles that we have. And so we may not know that we're identifying as a particular role or identifying as being young until we start getting old. And then we go, oh, dang, that wasn't just me. That was all the different parts and all the different causes and conditions. We know that we identify with the parts as the real me, and that gets us into trouble, like the whole empty nesters thing, you know, where you think this is you, then conditions change and now your role is gone and now it's confronting. Who am I? Or you can have the opposite end when you first begin uni and you feel like an imposter. Imposter syndrome. I shouldn't be here. I don't have the qualifications. I'm just pretending. And we identify with those parts. So any thought, that kind of entitlement, don't you know who I am? That's also identifying with these parts of this mind. And also then mere name. I put a picture here of an artist because so many artists, when they were alive, were just called madmen. You know, then they died and now suddenly they're an artist. It's imputation. So the understanding that we get from this is because of these dependencies, therefore, there is no real me. That's what the selflessness is. So it's not nihilistic, it's actually liberating. That's why we can change. And that's why we can become a Buddha. We'd be in big trouble if there was a real me. So who am I? Who am I really is, you know, Miffy imputed to body and mind. And very impermanent. So let's have a go with the royals. Really royal? So just recently, Megan, what's it? Megan and Bill? Harry? Megan and Harry were in Australia, weren't they? Anyway, the poor, silly royals, when they first moved to America, I just thought, wow, they thought they would stay the same, didn't they? We could see it was laid bare for everybody. They thought they were really royal. So what happened? What are the causes and conditions of being royal?
Mm-hmm.
Wealth, birthright, yes, genetics, birthright.
Grandmother's the queen.
The way people treat them, that's right. So they've got to be, I mean, they have to be appointed, isn't it, by government. They have to be recognised as sitting royalty. We're not going to have any bastard sons here, thank you very much. There's probably lots of them, but they're not recognised. Causes and conditions. What about parts? It's a slightly trickier, but if you look at a royal, what makes up a royal? What makes someone a king or a queen? A castle, a crown, an entourage. That's right, wealth, jewels, throne. If you didn't have all of those things, would you be a king or a queen? Past, present, future. So the parts, you've got to come into your age, you know, to become a sitting royal.
Coronation,
that's right. And you pretty much have to function as a royal as well, do royal things.
You have to go and do some sort of ambassador work or something.
Yeah, ambassador work. Do you think you need moral standing? Yeah, so this is really interesting. I'm not sure. So the other one, Andrew, so he's been banished, but is he still royal?
No.
No, why not? They stripped him of his titles. That's right. He probably thought he was really royal as well, would last forever. So it's a dependency, isn't it? What about imputation? So this...
Well, when the press get involved.
When the press get involved, yeah.
There's a lot of drama.
So that actually creates even more royalty, doesn't it? I suppose, this being believed in by the populace.
I guess that's a bit like Harry. No one
yeah, that's right. So he's in a grey area. He's not technically
he's
a royal. And so what makes him royal is the attention from others. But then again, I'm looking at it and go, well, they live in America. Most Americans are like anti-kings, aren't they? No kings. That was what it was founded on. But they love celebrities. So perhaps he's a celebrity and not a royal. And that's why, you know. But I'm pretty sure that when they moved to America, they felt, I am really royal.
They didn't get it.
And then everything came crashing down, but mostly this inability to grasp that it's a dependency. Mm-hmm. And because of that, then they were surprised that they were kicked out, that they didn't get bodyguards and all of those things, that some people just go, well, whoever. Mm-hmm. So do you know what actually makes somebody royal, like in the beginning? Like, how come I can't just say, well, by the way, I'm royal?
Yeah.
Birth. But what was the? What about the first one?
One.
They had a fight, won, and said, ta-da, I'm royal. Is that what happened?
Because they call themselves royal.
So actually, I did look this up, and what makes you royal is that you're anointed by God. There's the holy oil in the church, and you are anointed with this holy oil, and that holy oil is blessed by God. So actually, to be royal, the populace needs to be Christian. Really, if we're gonna stick to what a royal is anointed by God with the holy oil from God. That's what makes it. Because otherwise, and that's what's called the valid base. It's conventional, but it's a valid base. And that's why I can't say, guess what, I'm royal. Well, see, the Japanese have what, shoguns, don't they? So emperors are different. And shogunates are different, and vice regents are different, and all the other traditions in the world that aren't Anglo-centric have all sorts of other things, but they're not called king or queen. They're called other things. That's what a royal is. Yes, a king and a queen, or a princess and a. But even then, the name has changed.
Yeah.
Huh? The
numerous terms.
Numerous terms.
Same as a king?
Well, that's Napoleon would have debated that. He was very specific to call himself an emperor and not a king.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So he could have his cake and eat it too. Yes, they do. And I'm not so sure how they distinguish what makes royal, except it's genetic. And but what made the first royal, it's always interesting to go back to that. Yeah. So there you go. That's the analysis in just, you know, 10 short minutes. We can see how it has such a profound effect on our life and how we get caught out by thinking we're really me because things change. We can get surprised and devastated when things change. But this also works in our favour because we're not really bad either. So one more short reflection. Again, settling your posture, feeling grounded in place and time. Setting an altruistic motivation that we can come home to our Buddha nature. Bring everyone home as well. And let's just take a moment to reflect on the Australian dream. The house, the kids, the security, the happy families, the success. But are we making a big mistake? Do we think it is real from there? So how did you learn to believe this image of home, the dream of success? Might be family stories or the media, culture quietly shaping our belief over time. Our idea of the Australian dream was absorbed gradually, not discovered as a fact. What happens if our house or our home cannot support peace, doesn't function? Without a sense of connection, even the dream feels hollow. Home depends on relationship, not real estate. Where do you believe that real safety truly lives? It might be in the Australian dream that we yearn towards, but it's experienced internally, something we mentally place there. So what freedom could appear if we loosened our definition of home? Perhaps as a belonging, even if it's not perfect conditions, from a fixed kind of promise into a flexible human creation. So our Australian dream does exist, but it doesn't exist inherently. It depends. So dedicate that we can all create a home, create a harmonious and kind world. Our dream can be the dream for all people, and that all people can become our people. Then you can bring your attention back to the room. Okay, so what does this mean for me? Number one, the way that we feel is not the way we are. And this is a real comfort. When things go wrong, just knowing this, it really lessens the sting of problems. When we ask, who am I really? The mere I. So the way we feel isn't how we are. We feel independent, permanent, autonomous, substantial, but actually it's far different from that. And Lama Yeshe often said how we can actually meditate on this is to just ask a really simple question. How do I interpret myself right now? It's a nice way of asking it. It's very skillful because it all depends how we look at it, and we perpetuate this image of ourselves, and we really want people to stick to it. Or we have this secret image of ourselves and we don't want anyone to discover it. But actually, it's an interpretation. So we can ask, oh, are we feeling a bit like a cat or a bit grumpy or a bit like just a big old moo? Are we interpreting ourselves as ugly or stupid or bad? So those kind of things stick because of our self-grasping, especially if we've been told those things as a child, we think they're true because of this habit of self-grasping. And so we can slowly undo that habit just by questioning. I think I was in my 20s when I realized, oh my gosh, I'm just a collection of reaction to circumstances. It was a big shock, not some kind of solid, unchanging identity. But then it's actually what liberated me because I didn't feel so stuck and trapped anymore. My husband at the time, my ex-husband, when we got together, he just had a crash and lost his car, and actually was in the middle of a nervous breakdown because his whole identity was entwined with having the car, independence. And he was like, I don't know, 38 or something, first time he'd ever caught public transport. Not a good age to learn. Doesn't do what you want it to do. So because how he interpreted himself without knowing it was bound up with being this independent person that could do what they wanted when they wanted, when that was taken away, he lost who he was, a sense of worth. So not only this, but how our suffering exists also doesn't exist in the way that we think. And we often think suffering is bad because it feels bad. But actually, suffering can make us a better person because if we don't suffer, we have no chance of developing empathy or compassion. We just can't. So suffering feels bad, but it isn't necessarily inherently bad. And I know when I'm going through suffering times, that's actually when I'm the most patient with people. And then I start feeling okay, and then I'm all impatient again. The other thing to remember also is that our happiness doesn't exist out there as it appears either. Because often we think I can only be happy if I have a car, or if I have this person, or if I have this job, or the Australian dream. But again, that's thinking that the appearances, the things out there, will bring me that happiness. And the happiness is an experience, it's not in the thing. So we don't have to obsessively follow our craving and grasping either. That's a real relief. So I would reckon one thing to be careful about is to not mix up the ultimate and the conventional. And normally what happens is we get them around the wrong way. So we normally think that there is this, that the conventional me is the real one. But actually it's the other way around. The conventional self, the dependently arising self, actually does exist. But it's conventional. It's not the ultimate one. It's there, but it's this whole, collection of causes and conditions and parts and how people respond to us. So, in actual fact, our conventional self depends, my conventional self depends on all of you. So, if has anyone ever been overseas and had culture shock? Yeah? Or come back and had culture shock? Either way. But this is what culture shock is, that we think we're real, but actually who we are is how everyone treats us. We go overseas and everyone's acting differently, and suddenly we don't know who we are anymore. So, yes, the conventional self does exist. It's there, but it's conventional. The ultimate me doesn't exist. It's empty. Okay, so last questions, comments. How are we going?
Oh.
You're just right filled up to here. So I'll tell you something really nice. Lama Zopa Mishe over here on the throne, he said, even just thinking about all of this stuff and just doubting inherent existence, even with a mind of confusion, is like an atom bomb to the delusions. It's that powerful. That's why you're tired, because it is like it's full on, but it isn't. Atom bomb to the afflictions, to the delusions. Spaciousness is like a it's a quality. Spaciousness is like maybe a feeling experience of emptiness. But it's a tricky term to use because there's different types of space, and it's a very technical term, compounded space and uncompounded space. And so you don't want to mix up terms. So when we're doing the analysis, it's like it's a scientific thing. So you've got to get with the program and get the right terms. However, there are many different terms for emptiness, because just like there are those levels of causes and conditions and parts and mere imputation, there are different ways of describing emptiness for each of those levels. So sometimes it's called suchness. Sometimes it's emptiness, empty of what? Of different things, depending on how subtle the analysis goes. Then there's the translation issue. So a lot of times it's been translated as voidness, which just sounds so bleak, doesn't it? Yeah. Spaciousness, I haven't actually heard that one, but
I was wondering
I
if
think
it's
it's
not quite the first year, it's some a little bit different.
spaciousness is more like an effect of understanding emptiness.
Okay, yeah,
And suchness is kind of a nice one, because it's got the possibility without the concretizing. So to know more about this, folks, you've got to go over to Discovering Buddhism, The Wisdom of Emptiness, and it's like top, it's out of the 14 topics, it's number 12. So it's like, you know, it can feel really dry because we have to do the analysis. And so that's why all the rest of the course comes beforehand, because we have the reason for the analysis. We can just see how crucial it is that we can loosen this grasping that we have. Because even grasping at problems, like we think, why will we grasp at a problem? But when we go, oh, no, that's grasping. So we want to be liberated from that. And we can't just do it in a Pollyanna way by going, it doesn't exist, because that doesn't work. And we can't just obliterate it with, you know, alcohol and drugs, because we can't keep taking them. It'd be great if they worked. But, like, I took vodka for a good old 15, 20 years, maybe, possibly longer, until it became toxic. And then I couldn't, then it didn't work anymore. So that's why we've got to look within, and we have to do the analysis if we want to be free. And we're so fortunate, because in this tradition, Lama Tsongkhapa put it all together into this program, step by step, of how to do the analysis. And so he started with conventional reality, and then you dismantle it all and you come to emptiness. And then with that understanding, you come back to conventional reality. And that's the real unique thing about Lama Tsongkhapa. And so that's like we're all walking around with our true existence appearing glasses on, the blue glasses. We see the blue snow mountain. Sure, no problem. But we know it's white snow. Or we see the blue milk and we know what's happening. And this is this beautiful, delicious, fine kind of exquisite balance between how things appear and how we know that they exist. They appear one way as solid and independent and everything, but we know they exist in a different way. The ultimate mode of existence, emptiness. So, yes, things depend on cause and conditions, parts and imputation. This means that ultimately they're empty of existing in a fantasized manner. Two sides of the same coin. And once we understand this, we can take the pot off the boil. And isn't that lucky? Because you remember how many delusions there were? 84,000. Oh, my God. Only 84,000. And so the homework is just having that really healthy doubt. How am I interpreting myself right now? So that's what to think about for the coming week. Whatever situation you find yourself in, pleasant, unpleasant, it's not going to matter. You just ask the question. And watch Botched. It's so amazing, that show. It's just like for the Buddhist analysis, it's really good. So let's dedicate, and we'll do an emptiness dedication. Don't worry, it's short. So take a nice deep breath and feel really happy for putting in the effort and making all of those delusions and afflictive emotions run scared. Having the healthy doubt about the nature of reality that is like an atom bomb to the delusions. Dedicating for our own full awakening or enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. Dedicating in emptiness due to all the past, present, and future merits accumulated by you, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all sentient beings, which are empty from their own side. May we, who are which is empty from its own side, and lead all sentient beings who are empty from their own side to that enlightened state as quickly as possible by ourselves alone.